Hi, my name is David Weiss, and you are listening to A Conversation with Educators with music by Tom Fahey. This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share-alike license, which means you are free to remix it and share it, so long as you give attribution and let others have the same rights. Today I'm talking to David Miles and Fred Mindlin.
Hi, Fred. My name's David Weiss.
Hello, David.
Fred Miles.
And I work in Vancouver, British Columbia, in a private school. And my friend David is also on the line.
Hi, David.
I'm David Miles. I'm currently in the UK, but I teach at an international IB school in Bangladesh currently.
Wonderful. I'm working with the Central California Writing Project in Santa Cruz, Watsonville, California, as a teacher consultant, coaching on digital storytelling and related writing work.
So we are, I guess, having a conversation, and I think that we can kind of be free about what direction we go, although, as I recall, this came up as part of the EdChat on Twitter, so, and the topic there was educational reform. Are you guys interested in continuing in that direction? Fred, I think you wanted to talk about a piece of policy you're trying to write right now, or a proposal.
Well, I'd be concerned with the drift of so-called educational reform in the United States ever since the beginning of the No Child Left Behind Act, which basically has mandated a kind of drill-and-kill, test-prep-oriented instruction that's really destroyed any possibility for meaningful learning in American schools. And I really see this as a racist and classist enterprise designed to completely remake an educational system which already was basically geared toward producing low-wage industrial workers into one that is really beating poor kids over the head with rote learning, rather than allowing for any kind of creativity.
Well, and it's interesting because Dave and I both work in the IB system, the International Baccalaureate System, which is polar opposites to what's happening in the United States. So we have, and we still see issues with our colleagues and with our schools that we'd like to see improved. But certainly we have a lot of experience working in a system which works really well that doesn't involve a lot of standardized testing.
I have one I've had in my career two wonderful windows into the way that education in a public school system in the United States can still be creative, student-centered, and project-based. In my elementary teaching career, I worked for 10 years at a charter school which was within the public system and really didn't differ that much from the ordinary structure of public schools, except that went charter in order to keep our bilingual program when California outlawed bilingual education. But we were then able to just continue with our student-centered, project-based approach, where teachers at each grade level would collaborate on curriculum, share lesson prep, exchange students, do some differentiated instruction based on need, all those kinds of things which are no longer possible in the scripted classrooms which are now prescribed and even under Obama are going to be even more prescribed than before, which is kind of shocking to realize.
Well, and it's interesting because there are such systems out there which seem to work a lot better. So I guess our question is, if we can see these systems out here, we can see, and you're not alone. I mean, everybody here who talks about education that I've talked to really sees that the prescribed rote learning is ineffective. Given that that's true, why are we headed in that direction? And what can we do to change the direction? Like, what action can we take?
It's easy. I mean, why are we headed in that direction is simply because it's easy. The problem with all of the other all of the other ways of doing things is that you you lose an awful lot of control, and you have to be prepared to allow that to happen. When you're facing schooling systems, whole societies, whole areas of the country where, you know, you're having very serious discipline issues and things like that, the whole idea of relinquishing control is a very, very scary one. And that's probably part of where things like No Child Left Behind came from. I mean, they're rooted in ignorance. They're decisions being made by people who don't know what they're talking about and aren't in a position to, or just ignorant. They have no ability to think outside the box. I think we have to be very careful about saying, you know, it's their fault and stuff like that. If you have no real awareness of anything else and no other way of doing things, it's very difficult to come up with new ideas. So I think what we have to think about is, okay, well, we can see that there are issues with that. How do we go about opening people's eyes to those, and how do we get them prepared to take the risk necessary?
Yes, I mean, as you say, relinquishing control, you say that as sort of an abstract phrase, but what we're actually talking about, I think, is bureaucrats and administrators relinquishing control to teachers. And what I see as the biggest opening that we have towards real reform is empowering teachers. That's part of why I'm so excited about the work I do with the National Writing Project, because the Writing Project's model is based on teachers as researchers, as learners themselves, as participants in personal learning networks and collaborative learning networks that really are focused on the actual experience in the classroom of teachers with their students. Whereas so far, at least in the U.S., all of the reform efforts are designed by, implemented by bureaucrats and administrators who are almost always very far away from any real classroom experience.
Yeah, that's true. And I remember that. I worked in the U.S. for 3 years, and I do remember that there was very little, like even question asking, like, what do you think would work? And then moving ahead with the decision by administrators. And I think that's true not just in the United States system. I think that's true across the board. I don't think there are very many systems where the people at the lowest level have sort of an influence on the people on the highest level. And certainly in education, it's one of those areas where you really want to have the people who know what's going on a regular basis have some sort of influence on the decisions and policies that are implemented in the classroom. In the IB model, what they do is they promote people into positions of power through becoming workshop leaders, or examiners or moderators of other people's work. And then those people eventually get tapped into being, you know, actual administrators of the IB policy. The problem, of course, is that process can take 20 years before somebody from the classroom is actually implementing policy. And I think that's true in many different educational circles, that the length of time it takes you from when you're in the classroom full time to when you are creating policy that affects thousands of students is such a long period of time that education changes a lot in those 20 years, or what research shows would be effective, it changes a lot. We had the same conversation 20 years ago. I mean, think about the changes that would be different. And we would be talking about computers. We might be talking about how some schools have a computer to use for some students, but we wouldn't be talking about trying to get one for every student. So I think that this delay between when people have influence and when they learn about what's effective is part of the problem.
So the only way I can think of overcoming that delay is to work hard at creating a snowball effect. You need people who know what they're talking about to get themselves into positions of power. The more people who know what they're talking about, the more likely you are to get those people moving into positions of power. If it's only 5 or 10 people, nothing's much going to happen. If you're talking about hundreds and thousands of people, then you're really going to get impetus. And if you have those people, you know, asking questions and kicking up a fuss of their principals and their directors and school districts and things like that, things are more likely to happen. So in terms of, you know, instigating change, things like the work you're doing with teachers is exactly moving in that direction. It's spreading the word, as it were. And what you need to, I guess what we need to be doing is encouraging those people to go and have these conversations in their own schools and set up their own, activities of that kind, moving things further and further out. But then also, as Dave and I were talking before you joined in, Fred, finding sort of publishing articles and writing about what people are doing, in order to get more people aware of what can be done and what is taking place.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think that, again, to highlight one of the great strengths of the National Writing Project's model, when teachers really see themselves as researchers and are supported in and motivated to publish their own experience as research in the educational research community, then it's possible that these so-called reformers among the bureaucratic class will be hoist on their own petard, because we can point to actual research which shows that a student-centered project-based approach is actually much more effective at accomplishing the goals of improving student learning.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that I would like to see more access to educational research. Right now, when I do searches for articles, etc., I keep getting blocked by proprietary systems that sort of say, okay, well, you know, teachers publish this research, but you know, I'm sorry, but we're going to make you pay to read it. And I think that sort of payment option comes out of the peer review process, because people feel like if I'm going to review somebody's paper or 1,000 papers, that I should get paid for it. And I wonder if your project or if there are other projects out there which allow teachers to sort of say, well, here's my research, and I'll let everybody who wants to read it comment on it and, you know, fix up the research. And that'll be my peer review process. So what do you think about that?
Well, it's hard to see that kind of open sharing really replacing the academic journal publication route to legitimacy in the scholarly world. I think there are some options through publishing as a Google Doc and through utilizing the resources of Google Scholar to circumvent some of those proprietary database restrictive systems. But it is a huge challenge. We just faced it with our Summer Institute, where we wanted our participating teachers to be able to do educational research online. But for the first time, we were hosting our institute away from the University of California campus, where we normally held it. Well, the UC system restricts use of their databases that they subscribe to people who are physically present on the campus. So since we weren't physically there except for one day when we visited the library, we couldn't actually use the databases that the university does make available to people who are on their campus. It is a huge challenge, and I'm not quite sure how, you know, it's part of, in a way, the copyright Creative Commons debate.
I've got a suggestion. How many, what proportion of teachers in the U.S. would you say are part of a union?
Oh, it's maybe 10 or 20% at the most.
Okay, well, as a starting point, one thing to do would be to start talking with unions about making membership of some of these big databases an integral part of membership of the union. That gives you a group of people who then have basically free access.
Right.
Great idea. I'm definitely going to approach our union about that.
That's a minimal, you know, they're talking about hundreds and thousands of members. You're talking a minimal cost per member. They should be able to soak that up and maybe put the fees up, you know, in a few years' time by a couple of dollars to soak that up. I mean, they should be able to do that. Another thing that you need to do then is also start promoting the idea within schools, that within a school, that they be purchasing access to these as part and parcel of being in the school. I mean, the whole idea of, you know, schools, school districts, you know, we should have research environments. Teachers should be able to participate in research. And they should be, again, providing this subscription as part and parcel of working for them.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's minimal cost. I mean, if you talk about a school district with 100,000 teachers or whatever, you know, working for them, that district should be able to talk to EBSCO or something like that and get, you know, minimal fee charges for that kind of thing. It's a very easy thing for them to do that opens up that to a much wider audience.
That's a great idea, Dave. And I think that that kind of idea is something which we know would have an influence because it would allow a greater number of teachers to participate in the more formal debate, which I think a lot of policy people read. And it would also be something that would be really straightforward, like, look, we want to do research-based teaching, and all we need is this relatively cheap access. It's certainly much cheaper to do that than it would be to put a computer in the hand of everybody.
Yeah, but one of the things you have to be careful with, and this is the response that your principal and other bureaucrats will come back to you with, is, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but it's not necessarily going to make them drink. And it's the same kind of thing with this. You can make all the research available, but how are you going to create an environment for teachers that puts them in a position where they are working with that? You know, you can deliver a newspaper to my house every day, but I'm not necessarily actually going to read it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if what you're talking about is a change in the change in the way I do things. I'm busy. You're asking me to dedicate time to reading a whole bunch of articles and things that a load of them is going to be complete guff. And it's just, how do you get out there to this vast quantity or proportion of teachers who aren't doing anything like this and change their habits?
I think the outreach really has to come through changing the way people think about staff development. So much of staff development is caught in this hackneyed cliche of the sage on the stage lecturing to a bunch of bored teachers who are correcting papers and not paying any attention. But when you develop a whole staff development model that's based on teachers taking charge of their own staff development and not just delivering it themselves, but actually setting the agenda, what do we need to be studying about in order to improve our practice in the classroom, then teachers feel empowered and are motivated because it really is meaningful to them.
Well, that's one of the things that I know, Dave, I know you've done, and I know we've done here. We've called it Teachers Teaching Teachers. We've done it, we did it twice last year, and I know we're planning to do it a lot more next year. And it is simply to assign one of the periods of, you know, assign a period of time with a purpose of professional development and ask teachers to submit proposals for something that they want to talk about. It doesn't have to be deep and meaningful. It has to be, you know, it just has to be something that is associated with teaching. It can be teaching how to use a certain tool. It can be talking about an educational approach. But that is something that comes directly from the teacher. And that's a very, very easy thing to set up in terms of, I mean, that there are no costs involved in that. You just simply have to give over. All you really need is an hour at the end of the day, a couple of times a year.
Well, and what's really nice about that
I was just going to say, teaching teachers, teachers teaching teachers is the motto of the National Writing Project.
Oh, that's awesome. I was going to say that what's really nice about that model is that you can start really simply and you can build. You can sort of have one teacher takes charge and goes to administration and says, hey, can I have 20 minutes in the next staff meeting? We want to talk about something. And the administrator goes, well, that's 20 less minutes of planning I have to do for that staff meeting. Yeah, okay. And you do that often enough, and you end up with a sort of professional learning community at the school.
Another point I wanted to bring up, one of the other things besides the wonderful design of the organization of the school and the approach to curriculum that we had at the two-way bilingual immersion charter school where I taught, we also had probably the best administrator I have ever heard of in the United States who was completely transparent about the entire budget process. So he would simply put out a spreadsheet at the beginning of the year with all the projected revenues, his projected use of those revenues, and call for comments from the teaching staff. That's extremely rare in the U.S. It's amazing how hidden where the money comes from and where it goes is in so much of the U.S. educational system.
And I have to be honest, I've been teaching for 8 years, and I've never had a chance to see a school budget. Dave probably has.
Well, yeah, no, I probably have a couple of times, but not in very much detail, and certainly not happening right now. Little bits and pieces of it. But, yeah, you're talking about openness in budget. You'd like to see more. I mean, what you're talking about is a desire for more openness in educational processes generally, that the teachers be considered as valid active participants in the way the school is designed and the way it goes. I mean, this is something that I know that I talk about a lot in terms of my approach to the job I do. Fred, I'm a mathematics teacher originally, but I'm also now the academic coordinator in my school. I'm overseeing a wide variety of different things, but we need to find ways of, I think you've used the term yourself, empowering teachers, setting things up so that teachers have a sense of participating in what's going on. And that things stop being imposed from outside, but that, you know, teachers do have the ability to participate in the development of policy within the school and things like that.
I wanted to bring up, that reminds me of another huge issue that affects education in the U.S. Tremendously, which is the power of the textbook publishers. And it makes me think, in the context of this conversation, how important the whole open source textbook movement is. There's very little actual participation and opt-in in U.S. schools into that. But it is definitely something that those of us who are pushing for reform are bringing up and advocating for. The textbook publishers just have an inordinate control over what gets taught in schools, and it's mostly a really destructive influence.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I can speak a little bit to that. I've had the opportunity to write a textbook for a major publisher, and what was nice about the process we used for writing our textbook is that the co-author and I pretty much had complete control over what went into it. And part of the reason why we had so much control is because the area that we're writing the textbook for is the International Baccalaureate has sort of a sense of, well, let's give the teacher some control. But it wasn't an open textbook, and I think that I prefer the open source model for textbook writing, or the no textbook at all model, because I sometimes find that textbooks lead to scripts, which leads to really poor teaching. I think that a lot of teachers would be a lot better if they didn't. I mean, I started out my first year, I didn't get my textbooks until a month in. to the year. And actually, I think that made me a little bit stronger because I had to come up with my own resources and sort of thinking out through myself what I felt had to be taught. So either no textbook or open source textbook, I think, would be ideal.
I hate to say it, folks, but this sounds I keep coming back to remembering a friend and colleague in Colombia. He is a very, 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 very good English teacher, and he was teaching in local schools. He felt an awful lot of responsibility to the people in that area and wanted to do his absolute best for them. And there were several of us who worked with him who knew how good he was, and it took us quite a long time to persuade him that what he needed to do was move away from the school and the area that he was working in, and that he had, in some ways, an obligation to move further up the food chain, as it were. Did his master's, he's now in the States doing his PhD, but that because he's got skills and abilities, he is not only good at teaching children, but also good at teaching teachers. And I think what we are all talking about here is basically more work for ourselves, in that this is how we go about sharing things with other people and getting them to take on board these ideas, about getting people into policy-making positions and stuff like that. Well, maybe we are some of the people who need to choose to do that ourselves.
Yeah, that's a good point, David.
I mean, Fred, you're in a position where you're an educational consultant currently.
Yes, and I spent, after spending 10 years as a classroom teacher, I spent my last 7 years functioning as an administrator, but I did all of that as a teacher on special assignment. So I was being paid a teacher salary rather than an administrator salary, but I felt like it was very important for me to maintain my independence from the bureaucracy and the hierarchy in that position. And I'm still very reluctant to get involved directly in taking an administrative kind of position.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that reluctance. You have to be careful about how much there has to be a buy-in to the structures and ways of doing things that are there. So, you know, some of that is just being very, very picky about the role you take. I know for myself, for example, I'm in an administrative position now, but it's in an environment and system where I am able to propose change and, instigate new activities and get things going. And I think we have to be very, very careful of assuming that just because it's an, just because of the kind of position it is, that we're going to end up unable to do the things we need to do.
Well, I think we've had a really good discussion here, and I think we could probably continue it for a lot longer. But I'm wondering if you guys have any sort of closing thoughts.
I would just really encourage people to look at the work of Adele Diamond. She's a professor of psychiatry at UBC and was one of the originators of developmental cognitive psychology. There's a wonderful resource, an interview that Krista Tippett from Speaking of Faith did with her, where she talks about how important play, games, and creativity are for learning. And it's really the basis for my call for educational reform based on going back to the 100-year-old ideas of what we used to call progressive education.
Okay.
David?
I think there's a lot of scope for bring people outside the sort of very niche group of interested people more involved and more aware of what's going on. I think we do complain about the slowness of the process, but that is part of it. But I think we need to look at ways of becoming actively involved in affecting policy and spend less time perhaps waiting for other people to do it and become more active ourselves. When you're having conversations in things like EdChat and stuff like that, actively encouraging people to take it beyond the computer and the online conversation and go kick up a fuss elsewhere.
Yeah, I totally agree with both of what you guys are saying. I think that we need to move beyond the conversation. And I think that, Fred, you're right, that we need to use somebody who's got, you know, the right idea and a position of influence as a professor and use her ideas and sort of say, hey, look, have you read this one yet? To the policymakers and become policymakers ourselves. Well, thank you very much for you guys for your time, and I'd love to continue this conversation, but I think that I need to do some action now, and maybe I'll write a letter or blog about this experience.
Cool. Great. Well, thank you very much. Dave, I love your phrase, kick up a fuss. That's a good motto.
Yeah.
Okay, so talk to you again another time. Bye-bye.
Okay, talk to you later. Thanks.